You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel.
Coming up this week, the shooting in Virginia and the media coverage. How close are we to an economic meltdown? House of Fools cancelled. All after this, from Suzanne Vega.
Even if I am in love with you, all this to say, what's it to you? Observe the blood, the rose tattoo of the fingerprints on me from you. Other evidence has shown that you and I are still alone. We skirt around the danger zone and don't talk about it later. Marlena watches from the wall, her mocking smile says it all. She records the rise and fall of every soldier passing. But the only soldier now is me. I'm fighting things I cannot see. I think it's called my destiny that I am changing. Marlena on the wall. Well, I walk to your house in the afternoon by the butcher shop with a sawdust room. Don't give away the goods too soon is what she might have told me. And I tried so hard to resist when you held me in your handsome fist and reminded me of the night we kissed and of why I should be leaving. Marlena watches from the wall, her mocking smile says it all. She records the rise and fall of every soldier passing. But the only soldier now is me. I'm fighting things I cannot see. I think it's called my destiny that I am changing. Marlena on the wall. Marlena watches from the wall. Mocking smile says it all. She records the rise and fall of every soldier passing. But the only soldier now is me. I'm fighting things I cannot see. I think it's called my destiny that I am changing. Marlena on the wall. And even if I am in love with you, all this to say, what's it to you? Observe the blood, the rose tattoo of the fingerprints on me from you. Other evidence has shown that you and I are still alone. We skirt around the danger zone and don't talk about it later. And I tried so hard to resist when you held me in your handsome fist and reminded me of the night we kissed and of why I should be leaving. Marlena watches from the wall, her mocking smile says it all. She records the rise and fall of every man been here, but the only one here now is me. I'm fighting things I cannot see. I think it's called my destiny that I am changing, 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 changing. Marlena watches from the wall, her mocking smile says it all as she records the rise and fall of every soldier passing. But the only soldier now is me. I'm fighting things I cannot see. I think it's called my destiny that I am changing. Marlena on the wall.
From her debut album 30 years ago, that's Santa Monica's Suzanne Vega with Marlena on the Wall. It reached number 21 as a single over here in the UK in the same year, 1985. This is podcast 218. Hello, I'm Terence Dackham. She's Juliet Lucy Harris.
I am, yes, still. Hello.
I've been at it again with the anagrams.
Let's see what you've got this time.
Well, for new listeners, last 2 weeks I've been trying to form anagrams of Juliet Lucy Harris.
Because why would you not? It's the most leisure activity that everybody's doing nowadays, yeah.
You know, I might be sitting at lunch on my own on a Monday lunchtime, as an example, as happened this week, and just think to myself, I know what I'll do. I'll create anagrams of Juliet Lucy Harris.
It's nice to be in your life in that way. It's a great honour.
I think anybody would do it. They're all, each of them are linked, and they're linked in a way that if you changed your way of earning a living as a lawyer, at the moment you are a lawyer and you work in a particular field, but if you moved into the sort of fields of, you know, the Old Bailey. These anagrams would all be, it's the word apposite. I think that's what it is. Anagrams of Juliet Lucy Harris. I hurry all justice.
Oh, wow. I really like that. That's so good.
Yeah, you see
you
that?
You can't hurry love, but you can hurry justice.
Hi, cull arty juries. Which could work in many forms. You know, it could be a sort of Alan Yentob type thing, you know, well, culling arty juries. But, you know, it could also
work if you turned up in court and someone was in a beret, for example. Yes, can you remove that? Because you can ask for jury members to be removed sometimes under certain circumstances. So he's in a beret. I don't want him. Or she's got a really long green scarf on. I don't want her.
Or carrying a copy of The Guardian open at the media page.
Yes,
that sort of thing.
Yes, quite.
I shut Curly Jailer.
Oh, wow. Gosh. Mm. Clearly, I've ignored normative determinism because obviously the Juliet Harris fighter of crime.
Exactly.
Soon appearing on ITV as a pilot, by the way. But yes, what can I say? You've shown me a whole new way of thinking about my name and my career.
If Bob Marley was still with us, you know, he would be writing a song. I shut Curly Jailer.
Yes.
But I didn't shoot the deputy.
I didn't shut the deputy. Yes,
yeah, okay. Exactly.
Absolutely. Well, if only Bob were still with us, then that will become a reality. Well, thank you very much. I'm a fan of all three of those, and shall possibly get my name changed by Depol. So if only to have it on my passport, because that would look quite good, I would think.
Oh dear. Well, Jules, yet again this week, the focus on a more serious level. The focus has been on gun law in the USA following the terrible shooting of two journalists in Virginia. As we might have expected, Donald Trump was eager to state that controlling access to guns was not the solution, but tackling mental health issues could help, as if the two were mutually exclusive. Although the United States remains a long way from significant change to gun controls, we are hearing at least louder voices from those in powerful positions. Hillary Clinton and President Obama's press secretary both called for action, as did Terry McAuliffe, the governor of Virginia. But it's getting changed through Congress that continues to be the challenge. Guns don't kill people. People kill people. What do you think, Jules?
I think guns are extremely helpful in killing people. I must admit, I just despair over the situation of gun control in the US. I really do. And part of me thinks, oh, well, no, I shouldn't judge people. And it's a different culture over there. But, you know, guns kill people. Guns are dangerous things. They're not just used for, quote unquote, self-protection. I just don't understand, because we could have this conversation about a shooting in the US every day, frankly. We could do this story again next week and the week after and the week after that, etc., if we wanted to, because I'm sure something else will happen. And I don't know how many it has to take for people to realise that, you know, the thing is that, you know, everyone has a right to bear arms, etc. When someone's dead, that is it. You can't reverse that. That has happened. And Donald Trump's comment about mental health is interesting, actually, because as if the two are mutually exclusive. Of course, virtually every school shooting that we've heard about, you know, since the year dot, there's always been a sort of a mental health issue, in the sense that they've said, oh, the very vulnerable young adult, etc., etc. And the idea that people that are vulnerable have easy access to guns is a recipe for disaster, and will always be a recipe for disaster, in my view. And I mean, it's difficult to say anything massively articulate about this, because I just despair. And I thought that Obama seemed a bit more enlightened and would get a bit more of a grip on this. And it's very telling that his press secretary and Hillary Clinton are calling for more controls. Yet, I haven't read anything from Obama on this. I haven't seen any sort of call for control from him. And I just don't know how this is going to continue to be happening. If you think what happened over here when we had Dunblane, which admittedly was very much, you know, still a bit more of a one-off. But I hate to say fix the problem, but moves were done to tighten things up. And it hasn't really happened again, has it? Well, not on that scale anyway. And I find it slightly appalling that for me, it feels like the idea of sort of a right to bear arms and gun culture seems to be prioritised over human life every single day. That puzzles and upsets me.
Well, I think when any civilisation where you can walk into a Walmart and just say, oh, I'll have that gun over there, please, and some of your finest bullets, it is obviously going to have the potential.
I can't see how that's ever going to end well, Freddie. No, and I know that Michael Moore's not necessarily to everyone's taste, and there are some... although Michael Moore is probably talking to me as a lefty liberal type, there are films of his that I prefer to others. And Bowling for Columbine was perhaps towards the more hysterical end of Michael Moore films. But the scene where he takes a child, I can't remember if it's a child or a young teenager, but when he takes a young person into a Walmart who still has a bullet inside him and asks for a refund on the bullet, that is admittedly very, very powerful. Mm. And that always sort of sticks in my mind, but people say, oh, you don't understand American culture. No, I don't understand a culture which has such little respect for human life, frankly, or appears to.
It'll sadly probably need generations of change to get it through Congress, because Congress is so establishment and right wing that that's where Obama and Hillary Clinton can say as much as they like, but they don't have the power to change. Naturally, the Virginia shooting made headlines all around the world, especially as pictures, both still and moving, were instantly available due to the killer carrying a camera and his decision to post graphic material on social networks immediately.
And it was on live, and it was on live TV as well, wasn't it?
On live TV, indeed, as well, on the local affiliate that was running the interview at the time. Some newspapers, as examples in the USA, the New York Daily News, and here in the UK, the Sun newspaper, published stills taken from the gunman's perspective of, as I say, he had his camera with him, which was pulling in an argument not only about taste, but also that such a way of illustrating the story meant that the killer was telling the narrative. I should say that several other British papers used the same pictorial style on their front pages.
Yes, the only two that really didn't, curiously, not the most obvious of bedfellows, The Guardian and The Express. I can't believe we are living in a world where The Express
showing the way,
is restrained. Yes, that wasn't a surprise.
The Sun has also been accused of adding a cartoon-like flash from the barrel of the gun. If you didn't know the story and you saw that picture, you'd be forgiven for thinking this was a sort of screenshot from a video game. Do you think news outlets, should they just print and be damned, or is there a need for a more sensitive approach when covering such horror stories?
It again depressed me almost as much as the shooting did, because it made me realise sort of how desensitised we are nowadays. And the fact of the matter is that the reason those papers put those, or behind the thinking the people put those pictures on their pages, I thought it was incredibly tasteless and insensitive. But the fact of the matter was, if they felt that their readers would find it tasteless and insensitive, they would not have put those pictures on their pages. And it says a lot, most of it not good, about our society, that nobody in those offices, it would seem that the voices in those offices that said, hang on, this isn't a good idea, or I don't think people are going to want this, either didn't exist or weren't listened to, because they weren't seen as important, really. And I was thinking about this actually during the week, and you said that the images were taken from social media. And in a way, I think social media has done a great deal to desensitize us. And maybe that was behind the thinking of the people that put these photos on the pages. You know, everyone, and I can't exclude myself from this, although I am trying to be more careful, but so many of us put so much of our lives on Facebook and Twitter anyway, and share all manner of things that maybe they just feel that and also sort of, I don't want to rerun the ages old violent video game market argument, but given that we have these things that exist and are almost sort of normalized, it is deeply concerning that the people at the newspapers probably didn't even think there was a problem, or at least didn't prioritize it in terms of selling newspapers, because they knew those newspapers would still sell. And that again, I makes me kind of want to lay in my pyjamas and cry a bit, I must admit.
Well, absolutely. I was discussing this with a very, very old media hand earlier in the week, and I was having to remind him, you know, because he's older even than me, and he said,
"Wow, oh,
exactly."
<What's
his> God, no, I know, it's hard to believe. He said, you know, he was saying that, oh, I can't believe, you know, relating the social media aspect of this, of how young people, as you put it, you know, spread so much of their lives on Facebook and the Twitter. And I was explaining that if he spoke to my nieces and nephews in their teens and early 20s, they would have exactly the opposite view and would be saying, what have you got, what have you old people got to hide? You know, we just live our lives on. We've got open lives where, you know, you older people seem to be
secretive
and sort of, oh, you know, keep everything private. Don't, you know, close the front door, put net curtains up. Don't tell the neighbours, you know, where we're going, sort of thing. Young people, I know I'm generalising horrifically, but tend to be more of the view of, well, why not? What, you know, I'm just, it's less pressure and less stress
Sorry to interrupt. Part of the problem is, well, not exactly the problem, but part of that thing is that, again, massively generalising, as a younger person, you're perhaps, particularly as a teenager, you're more inclined to live for the moment, I think, because, you know, it's going to be years and years and years and years before you get old. You know, that is a long time ahead. And, you know, what you're doing now is the most exciting thing. And that's the danger, I think, that what sort of slightly older heads would realise is that, you know, with a few exceptions, once you put something out in the public eye of any sort of nature, it's there forever. It doesn't go away. And there's all, even if you take it off, you know, platforms, if you are able to prize it off Facebook and Twitter and prize your content away from Facebook, which is something of a holy grail anyway, I think. It, once you do that, this is like politics, that even once a scandal blows over, there's always going to be someone somewhere that says, oh yeah, wasn't that the girl that, I don't know, danced in Tenerife without a bikini on and it was on the news or something. You know, that this is the thing. I think what younger people don't realise and what I'm coming to realise, I'm quite careful on what I put on Twitter anyway, but you know, once you put something out there, it doesn't go away. And maybe in a way, I don't know, I'd love it if in an ideal world, people weren't going to buy the Sun, would think, and think, oh yeah, wasn't that the paper that put that terrible picture of the gun with the cartoon flash? But depressingly, it doesn't seem to be like that.
Exactly. So now we break up these podcasts with in total we have four pieces of music. We've already heard from Susan Vega. This next piece of music, I'm going to urge you in a rather patronising way, everyone, to really listen with open ears and don't judge, because I'll explain how I came across this in a few minutes. But yeah, we'll be back and we'll be wondering whether we should all be a bit more concerned about this week's stock market shenanigans right after this from Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds.
Just pass me by. You
ago, you would have found me in the same camp as many when it came to the Gallagher brothers, you know, a kind of ennui expressed with a shrug of the shoulders and a kind of meh.
Mm.
But quite soon after the video app Periscope was launched, I think it was in March of this year, someone used it to stream a gig by Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds. And I checked it out and I thought, well, you know, this is pretty good. You know, very tight sound, short melodic songs, funky backing singers. And I really liked it. But more recently, I was in a bar with some friends and we all became rather distracted by the music playing through the stereo in a very positive way. You know, one of those moments saying, gosh, you know, what's that? We asked what this was, and the woman behind the bar said it was the new-ish album Chasing Yesterday by Noel Gallagher's group, the High Flying Birds. And since then, it's just been a constant companion to me on Spotify. A great album and a real return to top form. Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds, Ballad of the Mighty Eye.
I love that you love this, because I was an obsessive Oasis fan in my sort of youth years. I thought they were brilliant. And then eventually I did switch to Blur once I got a bit older. But but yes, I was a big fan of them. And recently have had a renaissance with their later period albums, actually, which were better than I'd thought at the time. But Noel Gallagher's solo stuff is lovely. It's really, really good. And I even as a teenage Oasis fan, I'm surprised by how good it's been. I think it's, I mean, my mum is also was a big fan of the first album. She thought it was great, to the point where she was very anti-Oasis and refused to listen to it at first because it was Noel Gallagher. But actually she said, oh, I really like this. So yeah, Noel Gallagher widening his scope and his range, I think, definitely.
I mean, it's you know, it is very derivative. I think Graham Gouldman would be sort of listening to that, some of the chord changes there and thinking, they sound a bit familiar, sort of a bit bus stoppy and a bit sort of The Who substitute-y as well. But nonetheless, I don't mind that. I don't mind derivative.
If it's got a style about it that its own and it can keep you interested, then it doesn't really matter, does it?
I'd be very interested what you all think. I mean, increasingly people are contacting you and I on the Twitter.
Yes, indeed. To
tell us what they think about podcasts. I'd be really genuinely interested to know what you think.
Yes, I very much am, yeah.
Yeah, SuperJules84 and Sir Terence are our two Twitter homes. In the Independent newspaper this week, Damien McBride, the former advisor to Gordon Brown, said that we should all stock up on tin goods and bottled water as stock markets around the world, you know, slither and slided this week, as we know. Now, many might see that as quite alarmist, but it does bring into focus the absurdity that our planet revolves around a bizarre system based on a handful of people essentially gambling upon whether money markets may go up or down. It's not much different to betting with Paddy Power on how many yellow cards there will be in the Super Sunday 4 p.m. kickoff. The whole world's economy is running on a peculiar form of spread betting.
Well, it's hanging by a thread, isn't it, really?
Yeah, well, I mean, in many ways, I think it is. I think that Damien McBride may have had a point here. I mean, are you much of a supporter of this economic model?
Well, no, not really. Everything you say, I pretty much agree with, boringly for a podcast. But yeah, it does seem like the world economy, everything is so tenuous and it's hanging by a thread. And I think this week has brought home to us how little control we have as individual people that are not traders have over everything. I mean, Damien McBride is always inclined to be a bit of a character, shall we say. As someone said to me, a rather wizened political friend of mine said, who isn't old but is wizened through too much exposure to politics at a high level, said to me, must be August if Damien McBride is releasing stories in the paper. And there is an element of that, although he wrote a book called Power Trip I enjoyed it despite the fact that it was Damien McBride, if you see what I mean. But if anyone was going to say those things, it would be him. But it does make you think. I mean, I was talking to a friend of mine about this who is a counsellor, and I have experience of the last kind of major downturn, Lehman Brothers, because I think I'm happy to tell people this, because I buy and sell houses for a living. That's what I do. And I started training in sort of September 2007, and I jumped into a training in another area just before everything collapsed. And there was an 18-month period where I had worked in the conveyancing department of a firm, and there were probably about 35 of us there. So it was very much a boom at that point, and there was a whole floor of people working. And for every 3 or 4 weeks for about that 18 months, I'd get an email from someone I used to work with saying, please don't email me on this address after tomorrow because I've been made redundant. And that just seemed to happen over and over and over again. And so I've been watching it very carefully this week, because of course, in an indirect way, although it might seem that me buying or selling someone's house is not a big thing, if the stock markets go, that could potentially have serious consequences for the jobs of me and my colleagues above and below me. And that's where it's frightening, that you think, oh God, it affects us all when we have so little control over it. And my friend who's a counsellor, we were talking about sort of future plans, and I said, oh, you know, I think I'm going to overpay my mortgage because, you know, there's possibly might have a crash next year. And she said, oh, but, you know, St Leonard's is really up and coming. And I felt like saying, doesn't matter where it's up and coming or not. If this kind of, you know, total disaster happens, as it sort of did about 7 or 8 years ago, that's it, you know. People buying fancy wallpaper and that all stops. Everything stops, you know. All this Guardian weekend supplement, up and coming towns things, that all stops because no one cares, because everything is sort of the verge of collapsing. And interesting, an estate agent said to me once, oh yeah, he said, he was obviously quite experienced, and as estate agents go, was quite sensible. And he said, oh yeah, things tend to move, boom and bust. No matter what Gordon Brown said, it still moves in about 7 or 8 year cycles. So when I sat there and, as the Americans say, did the math, 2008 plus 7 or 8 makes it 2015 or 2016. So without sounding totally depressing, you know, these things happen, and I know that life continues because it did last time pretty much. But yes, I agree with you. The idea that we can all have our lives fundamentally changed by something we can't control is pretty alarming and hard to understand.
I think you're really illustrating how genuinely we are all living close to the edge, and maybe we shouldn't dismiss Damien McBride's advice too quickly. He has worked right in the heart of government about, I don't know, maybe a year or two ago. An MP friend of mine, I won't say, of course, who it was, told me how governments plan for a breakdown in society, and how it's estimated, according to my friend, that we're 4 meals from the general breakdown of law and order. This is
really
how governments work. Yeah, they work on the basis that lack of food and or water would be the quickest driver for people to revert to sort of Stone Age practices. And it's felt that after missing 4 consecutive meals as quickly as that, and with no further provision in sight, in other words, you can miss 4 meals but know that the cavalry is coming over the hill, that's something. But if you've missed 4 meals and you don't know where your next one is coming from, in so-called civilized society, it's thought that that would be the stage when people would begin to raid supermarkets and even be breaking into each other's homes.
Gosh.
So there's a cheerful thought.
Yes, I was going to say, yeah, that's really put me right up. Thanks, Terence.
we'll be back looking at the BBC's decision to drop the comedy show House of Blues after this by Wham. So get on down. So get on down. So get on down. Hey everybody, take a look at me. I've got street credibility. I may not have a job, but I have a good time with the boys that I meet down on the line. Said D-H-S-S. Man, the rhythm that they're giving is the very best. Yeah. I said B-1, B-2. Make a claim, sign your names, all you have to do. Well, folks will be a drag if work ain't your bag, and when you let them know, you're more dead than alive in a 9-to-5. Then they say you've got to go and get yourself a job, or get out of this house. Get yourself a job, you a man or a mouse. A finger in each ear, you pretend not to hear. Gotta get some space, get out of this place. Real hard, you can hear the sound of
for work. Well, listen, Mr. Average, you're a jerk. Not me, you can't hold me down. Not me, I'm gonna fool around. Gonna have some fun, look out for number one. You can dig your grave, I'm staying young. A jet black guy with a hip high five, a white cool cat with a trilby hat. Maybe leather and studs is where you're at. Make the most of every day. Don't let hard times stand in your way. Give a wham, give a bam, but don't give a damn, cause the benefit gang are gonna pay. Now reach up high and touch your soul. The boys from wham will help you reach that goal. It's gonna break your mama's heart.
So sad.
It's gonna break your daddy's heart.
Too bad.
But you'll throw the dice and take my advice, because I know that.
Wham Rap by Wham, which I selected this week. Hello to the one listening that's still stuck with us after this, by the way. I picked it partly because I was in a slightly mischievous mood, and after our conversation about sort of DWP and job seekers allowance last week, I quite liked the idea of picking a song that had the chant DHSS in it. That appealed to my slightly less than better nature. But also, I think it's a tremendous tune. And me and a friend of mine, after our conversation last week, had a long conversation about songs that were about people on the dole, and or songs about claiming benefit, and that of course fed into UB40, who we discussed last week as well. So I thought it was slightly topical, and also I DJ out with a friend of mine sometimes in bars, and we always have one record every time that causes debate between us, because I am a shameless populist and she is really cool, and this was the one this time where she saw me get the best of Wham out of my box, and we had a what are you doing moment, and it was also the one that had the whole bar dancing, including both of us. So yes, I'm a bit of a fan of Wham. Did you ever hear the story about George Michael and Hampstead Snappy Snaps, by the way?
Oh, when he drove into the front of it?
Yes, and some wag with a graffiti spray can wrote Wham with an exclamation mark on the front of the destroyed Snappy Snaps afterwards.
I'm going to shock you to your very core. If you knew this already, I'm not going to shock you to your very core. If you didn't know this,
it and forgotten, to be fair, so I will be shocked.
Wham Rap is Michael Gove's favourite rap track of all time. Yes, it is.
Oh, gosh.
Well, he's a big fan of your what you young people call the rap music.
Is he? Yes.
He is. And if you, I should urge you to listen to the very, very end, post-credits, post-final song of this very podcast, and there'll be a little Easter egg there, which again will surprise you to your very core, involving Michael Gove and Wham.
So wow.
Stick to the very, very end of this podcast.
Gosh, what a promise.
Yeah, there we are. The BBC has a substantial page on its website dedicated to explaining how television shows are commissioned and who is responsible for making the final decisions. Kim Schillinglaw is the controller for BBC Two, but lower down in what the BBC still calls its command structure. I love it. You could talk to a BBC manager and they say, oh, yes, I had a team meeting with my command today. You know,
it makes me think of people in gun turrets and stuff.
It really is.
It's probably what the BBC feels a bit like at the moment, I suspect.
It's a holdover from the early days of the BBC, when most of the managers were former military people, and they say, oh yes, I'll pass that on to my command, but they still use that term for the management structure in the BBC.
Danny Cohen stood at a large map of the world with one of those wooden sticks pushing boats across, going, oh, so if we push Ready Steady Cook across to 3:30.
lower in that command structure is Shane Allen, the commissioning controller of comedy. Now, on the other side of the net from Kim Schillinglaw and Shane Allen, is the show House of Fools, constructed, written and started by Reeves and Mortimer, Vic Reeves and Bob Mortimer. The first series of House of Fools lost viewers week on week, and it was rumoured that it was to be dropped. And then celebrity supporters, Damien Hirst, Stephen Fry, you know, the usual crew, chirped up and were all over the social media, as we were talking about earlier, and a second season was commissioned. And that this second season, which ran more recently, of course, attracted an average of about 1 million viewers per episode. Now, the BBC has decided enough is enough, and thus House of Fools will not return, at least not on the BBC. Jules, should the BBC have disregarded the viewing figures and allowed Vic and Bob to carry on with their tomfoolery?
Well, firstly, shame on you, BBC. You've broken a 74-year-old man's heart because my dad loved House of Fools. I don't really know why. He is very inexpressive generally and very unkeen to express his positive views on things. He's more keen to express his negative views on things. But
good on
He loves House of Fools to the point where it's one of the very few things that we're able to have unstilted conversation about at times. We both like House of Fools and have watched it together. I mean, it is ridiculous. When you say constructed by Vic and Bob at the beginning, that's a very, very loose use of the word. The expression constructed, isn't it, really? Because it is basically just two middle-aged men mucking around, isn't it? But it's interesting. I mean, there is an argument that, of course, back in the olden days, and by the olden days, depressingly, I mean the early 80s, only Fools and Horses, first series, bombed. It didn't get any viewers at all. The only reason it took off is because there was a cameraman strike or something at the BBC, and they didn't have any new stuff to show. So they repeated the whole series, you know, as a lack of any other programming over a summer, and it got better viewing figures being repeated because there wasn't anything else to watch, I suspect, as a result of which they then decided they would bring it back for a second series. And then it built and built and built, and at one point you had a third of the country watching it at Christmas. So part of me thinks it's a shame that stuff isn't given a chance to organically grow anymore. But then, having said that, you could argue they did give this a chance to organically grow. They gave it a second series, which again didn't really set the world on fire. We live in an age where the BBC has all sorts of competitors, not just, you know, Sky and the other channels, but also online. The BBC has lots of online platforms and programming, for example. So maybe they could have found a home for it elsewhere, as they're increasingly doing with BBC Three programming. But again, the counter argument to that is that the audience that was watching House of Fools, you would argue, is an older audience that's not a BBC Three audience. I'm not sure. I'm sad for people that liked it. But then equally, people like Damien Hirst and Stephen Fry that go... It felt a little bit to me like, oh, but you can't turn it off TV because I like watching this and I'm famous. And it did feel a little bit like that. And I think ultimately the BBC, it's damned if it does and damned if it doesn't. It's criticised for, you know, being this monolithic organisation with seemingly infinite resources. And then when it does pull the plug on something because it's not really achieving massive amounts of viewers and it doesn't have infinite resources, people then complain. So, I liked it. But then, having said that, you know, the BBC, you know, one can't have everything one wants in life, really, even if you're Stephen Fry.
Even if you're Stephen Fry, just, you know, he seems to get everything else that he wants. Comedy, of course, is a very personal matter.
It's so subjective, isn't it?
It is, of course. You know, I might be rocking with lols at some show.
Mega lols, yeah.
Mega lols that you may sit through stony-faced and vice versa. So this is clearly a personal view when I pose the question. I wonder if we sometimes will something to be funny, because...
House of Fools. I absolutely have.
Yeah, you know, I think anybody with a kind of interest in alternative comedy, and, you know, I don't know, with my background, I don't know whether one would have said at the time Spitting Image was alternative comedy. I wrote for that. I wonder, you know, I'm slightly biased because of that. House of Fools was perhaps too closely based on the old Vic Reeves Big Night Out concept.
Yes,
where,
it was very similar.
It was, wasn't it? You know, where nothing made sense. And that was the joke. But that was 25 years ago now.
And that's the problem. It did feel a little bit like rehashing of past glories. It felt a little bit like it wasn't trying to do anything new. It was just trying to do the same thing again and hope it worked. When, as you say, the world moves on, doesn't it? It's 25 years old, and it's very telling that... you know, I'm not saying that the young get everything right, but it was very telling that all of its supporters were people who I suspect were probably fans of them the first time round. And the fact of the matter is that you can't live off past glories forever, really. I didn't think it was any worse than anything else that's on, but that's not necessarily a ringing endorsement, is it?
No, it's not, is it?
No, you wouldn't put that on a film poster.
You wouldn't, would you?
Well, it's no worse than anything else that's around.
I felt the same. If I was in and it was on, I think, oh, I'll give that a watch. If I missed it because I forgot I was out, I thought, you know, it didn't really occur to me to think,
oh, you to iPlayer to watch it again. Yeah,
I think Vic and Bob's continued success is based upon continuing a need to reinvent themselves. For example, Shooting Stars was great, but, you know, don't try and bring it back now. And they need to continually move on, like sort of David Bowie, be the chameleons of comedy. And there's one show that I think would have suited them to the ground, but two other people got in and beat them to it. Coogan and Bryden beat them to it with the trip.
A
similar concept would work for Vic and Bob if they played themselves and didn't try to be too knowing. That would have worked great, I think.
Absolutely. No, I think that's a really good point. And actually, also, Vic Moyer, I think is his real name. He's now a serious actor, isn't he? And actually, everything I've seen him in, he's been really good.
So,
I don't know, maybe he might be better off trying to do that sort of thing. I'm not sure. But no, I agree. Vic and Bob, although I think the trip obviously would have been a very different, perhaps less restrained programme if it was Vic and Bob. But having said that, as you say, if they tried to play it straight rather than, you know, do this sort of fourth wall type stuff. I mean, they have tried to do other things before, to be fair to them. They did try and do Randall and Hopkirk Deceased, didn't they, for a little while, which again didn't seem to quite work.
Wasn't quite the right vehicle for them.
But they weren't the house of protest that we've had now when it was quietly dropped.
To say people contacting us, Jim Moir is...
I'm so sorry.
No, that's okay. Perhaps the cancellation of House of Fools will prove to be good for them, but they do need to find something different.
new and
different. And I'm not entirely sure if the rumours this week of a similar kind of situation to Clarkson and the Top Gear gang, that Netflix are apparently saying, oh, you know, well, we might be interested in commissioning that third series of House of Fools. I don't think that's the answer.
No, I don't think it is. Let it go, guys. I liked it, but... You know, sometimes it's time to move on.
Happily, we have been commissioned to return next week.
Hooray! to a grateful nation, yes.
In the meantime, if you want to contact us, we can be found on Twitter, SuperJules84 and Juliet Harris on Facebook. I'm Sir Terence on Twitter. What are we playing out with this week, Jules?
Well, our discussion last week about my love of songs with sections, hence we had that Wings Band on the Run. I thought, why don't I make a mini featurette of this? And I thought I'd pick this. We decided to put it last simply because it's not really possible to follow it with anything, I don't think. It's Paranoid Android by Radiohead. I remember first hearing this on the radio. It was probably Steve Lamacq. I don't think it made daytime radio in the 90s, and thinking, you know, just being completely struck dumb by it because it didn't sound like anything else that was going on at the time. And a friend of mine came around recently and we were watching one of the Jules Holland DVDs, one of the later DVDs. It's of some age, so I'm not sure if you can still get it, but it had all the, you know, we just watched it from start to end, so we watched all these performances and they had Radiohead Paranoid Android, and we both sort of although we'd heard it loads of times, we sat there in kind of stunned silence, and as it stopped the credits then rolled across the front of the screen, and we said, well, of course they must, because, you know, how could you move on from that, really? So this is my song with many sections for the week. This is Radiohead, Paranoid Android.
And we'll see you next time. Bye for now.
Cheerio.
You have been listening to a Dacom Media production.
You've recently said that you quite like rap music. So I was wondering, could you give us a taster of your favourite rap?
Well, the first rap I probably heard when I was younger was actually quite a vanilla rap, which was the Wham rap, you know, with Andrew Ridgeley and George Michael. Hey, everybody, take a look at me. I've got street credibility. I may not have a job, but I have a good time with the boys I meet down on the line.